harassing Miss Harris. But Miss Harris was a cool customer. If she knew that Gilly despised her, she never let on. So at this point, Gilly was not ready to pull her time-honored trick of stopping work, just when the teacher had become convinced that she had a bloody genius on her hands. That had worked so beautifully at Hollywood Gardens, the whole staff had gone totally ape when suddenly, one day, she began turning in blank sheets of paper. It was the day after Gilly had overheard the principal telling her teacher that Gilly had made the highest score in the entire school's history on her national aptitude test. But, of course, no one knew that she knew, so an army of school psychologists had been called in to try to figure her out. Since no one at school would take the blame for Gilly's sudden refusal to achieve, they decided to blame her foster parents, which made Mrs. Nevins so furious that she demanded that Miss Ellis remove Gilly at once instead of waiting out the year. The year Mrs. Nevins had reluctantly agreed to after her first complaints about Gilly's sassy and underhanded ways. But something warned Gilly that Miss Harris was not likely to crumble at the sight of a blank sheet of paper. She was more likely simply to ignore it. She was different from the other teachers Gilly had known. She did not appear to be dependent on her students. There was no evidence that they fed either her anxieties or her satisfactions. In Gilly's social studies book, there was a picture of a Muslim woman of Saudi Arabia with her body totally covered except her eyes. It reminded Gilly somehow of Miss Harris, who had wrapped herself up in invisible robes. Once or twice, a flash in the eyes seemed to reveal something to Gilly of the person underneath the protective garments. But such flashes were so rare that Gilly hesitated to say even to herself what they might mean. Some days it didn't matter to Gilly what Miss Harris was thinking or not thinking. It was rather comfortable to go to school with no one yelling or cajoling, to know that your work was judged on its merits and was not affected by the teacher's personal opinion of the person doing the work. It was a little like throwing a basketball. If you aimed right, you got it through the hoop. It was absolutely just and absolutely impersonal. But other days, Miss Harris's indifference grated on Gilly. She was not used to being treated like everyone else. Ever since the first grade, she had forced her teachers to make a special case of her. She had been in charge of her own education. She had learned what and when it pleased her. Teachers had courted her and cursed her, but no one before had simply melted her into the mass. As long as she had been behind the mass, she tolerated this failure to treat her in a special manner. But now, even the good morning smile seemed to echo the math computer's, "Hello, Gilly number 58706. Today, we will continue our study of fractions." Crossing threshold of classroom causes auto teacher to light up and say, "Good morning," but $3,000 additional, get the personalized electric eye model that calls each student by name. For several days, she concentrated on the vision of a computer-activated Miss Harris. It seemed to fit. Brilliant, cold, totally, absolutely, and maddeningly fair. All her inner workings shiningly encased and hidden from view. Not a Muslim, but a flawless, tamper-proof machine. The more Gilly thought about it, the madder she got. No one had a right to cut herself off from other people like that. Just once, before she left the stump, she'd like to pull a wire inside that machine. Just once, she'd like to see Harris 6 scream in anger, fall apart, break down. But Miss Harris wasn't like Trotter. You didn't have to be around Trotter 5 minutes before you knew the direct route to her insides. William Ernest Teague. Miss Harris wasn't hooked up to other people. It was like old Mission Impossible reruns on TV. Your mission, if you decide to accept it, is to get inside this computerized robot, discover how it operates, and neutralize its effectiveness. The self-destructing tape never told the Mission Impossible team how to complete their Mission Impossible, but the team always seemed to know. Gilly, on the other hand, hadn't a clue. It was TV that gave her the clue. She hadn't been thinking about Miss Harris at all. She'd been thinking, actually, of how to get the rest of Mr. Randolph's money and hadn't been listening to the news broadcast. Then somehow it began sending a message into her brain. A high government official had told a joke on an airplane that had gotten him fired. Not just any joke, mind you, a dirty joke. But that wasn't what got him fired. The dirty joke had been somehow insulting to blacks. Apparently, all the black people in the country, and even some whites, were jumping up and down with rage. Unfortunately, the commentator didn't repeat the joke. She could have used it, but at least she knew now something that might be a key to Harris 6. She borrowed some money from Trotter for school supplies and bought a pack of heavy white construction paper and magic markers. Behind the closed door of her bedroom, she began to make a greeting card, fashioning it as closely as she could to the tall, thin comic cards on the special whirl-around stand in the drugstore. At first, she tried to draw a picture on the front, wasting 5 or 6 precious sheets of paper in the attempt. Cursing her incompetence, she stole one of Trotter's magazines and cut from it a picture of a tall, beautiful black woman in an afro. Her skin was a little darker than Miss Harris's, but it was close enough. Above the picture of the woman, she lettered these words carefully. She could print well, even if her drawing stank. They're saying black is beautiful. Then below the picture, but the best that I can figure is everyone who's saying so looks mighty like a, and inside in tiny letters, person with a vested interest in maintaining this point of view. She had to admit it. It was about the funniest card she'd ever seen in her life. Gifted Gilly, a funny female of the first rank. If her bedroom had been large enough, she'd have rolled on the floor. As it was, she lay on the bed, hugging herself and laughing until she was practically hysterical. Her only regret was that the card was to be anonymous. She would have enjoyed taking credit for this masterpiece. She got to school very early the next morning and sneaked up the smelly stairs to Harris 6 before the janitor had even turned on the hall lights. For a moment, she feared that the door might be locked, but it opened easily under her hand. She slipped the card into the math book that lay in the middle of Miss Harris's otherwise absolutely neat desk. She wanted to be sure that no one else would discover it and ruin everything. All day long, but especially during math, Gilly kept stealing glances at Miss Harris. Surely at any minute she would pick up the book. Surely she could see the end of the card sticking out and would be curious. But Miss Harris left the book exactly where it was. She borrowed a book from a student when she needed to refer to one. It was as though she sensed her own was booby-trapped. By lunchtime, Gilly's heart, which had started the day jumping with happy anticipation, was kicking angrily at her stomach. By mid-afternoon, she was so mad that nothing had happened that she missed 3 spelling words, all of which she knew perfectly well. At the 3 o'clock bell, she slammed her chair upside down on her desk and headed for the door. "Gilly!" Her heart skipped as she turned toward Miss Harris. "Will you wait a minute, please?" They both waited, staring quietly at each other until the room emptied. Then Miss Harris got up from her desk and closed the door. She took a chair from one of the front desks and put it down a little distance from her own. "Sit down for a minute, won't you?" Gilly sat. The math book lay apparently undisturbed, the edge of the card peeping out at either end. "You may find this hard to believe, Gilly, but you and I are very much alike." Gilly snapped to attention despite herself. "I don't mean in intelligence, although that is true, too. Both of us are smart and we know it. But the thing that brings us closer than intelligence is anger. You and I are 2 of the angriest people I know." She said all this in a cool voice that cut each word in a thin slice from the next and then waited, as if to give Gilly a chance to challenge her. But Gilly was fascinated, like the guys in the movies watching the approach of a cobra. She wasn't about to make a false move. We do different things with our anger, of course. I was always taught to deny mine, which I did and still do. And that makes me envy you. Your anger is still up here on the surface where you can look it in the face, make friends with it if you want to. She might have been talking Swahili for all Gilly could understand. But I didn't ask you to stay after school to tell you how intelligent you are or how much I envy you, but to thank you for your card. It had to be sarcasm, but Harris 6 was smiling almost like a human being. When did the cobra strike? I took it to the teacher's room at noon and cursed creatively for 20 minutes. I hadn't felt so good in years. She'd gone mad like the computer in 2001. Gilly got up and started backing toward the door. Miss Harris just smiled and made no effort to stop her. As soon as she got to the stairs, Gilly began to run and, cursing creatively, ran all the way home. Dust and desperation. All at once, leaving Thompson Park became urgent. Gilly knew in the marrow of her bones that if she stayed much longer, this place would mess her up. Between the craziness in the brown house and the craziness at school, she would become like W.E., soft and no good. And if there was anything her short life had taught her, it was that a person must be tough. Otherwise, you were had. And Galadriel Hopkins was not ready to be had. But she must hurry. It didn't matter whether the people who hovered over her had fat laps or computer brains. For if a person could crack under heat or cold, a combination of the two seemed guaranteed to do in even the gutsy Galadriel. By now, she would have preferred to get Mr. Randolph's money on her own and leave both William Ernest and Agnes Stokes out of it. But in her haste, she acted stupidly and used them both. The opportunity fell into her lap unexpectedly. Trotter had never asked her to babysit with William Ernest before. But suddenly, 2 days after the card joke bombed, Trotter announced that she was taking Mr. Randolph to pick up a few things at the dime store, and would Gilly watch William Ernest while they were gone. It was too perfect. She should have realized that, but her anxiety to get the money and get going had fuzzed her common sense. With shaking hands, she leafed through the fat suburban phone book until she found the number for the Stokes in Thompson Park, who supposedly lived on Aspen Avenue. Another of the world's lies. The senior Stokes had long before left the Washington area, abandoning Agnes to a maternal grandmother, 75 years old, by the name of Gertrude Berkheimer. But Agnes's delinquent father was still listed in the directory just as though he had never left her. Agnes arrived immediately, nearly falling over herself with joy that Gilly had not only invited her over, but was actually asking for her help in carrying out a secret and obviously illegal plot. She agreed, without objection, to being the lookout at Mr. Randolph's house, although Gilly suspected she would have preferred an inside role. Agnes was to do her whistle, which she claimed could be heard a mile away. Should the taxi bearing Trotter and Mr. Randolph return while Gilly was still inside? Prying W.E. away from the TV and explaining his part to him proved far more difficult. "I don't understand," he said for what seemed to be the 30th time, blinking stupidly behind his glasses. Gilly started all over again from the beginning, as patiently as she could. "Mr. Randolph wants you and me to do him a favor. He's got something on the top shelf in his living room that he needs, and he can't see it to get it down. I told him you and me weren't too busy this afternoon, so he says, 'Miss Gilly, could you and William Ernest, who is just like a grandson to me, do me a tremendous favor while I am busy at the store?' So, of course, I told him we'd be glad to help out, you being just like a grandson to him and all." She paused. "What kind of favor?" "Just get this stuff down off the shelf for him." "Oh, then what stuff?" "William Ernest, I haven't got all day. Do you want to help or not?" He guessed so. Well, it would have to do. They had already delayed far too long. She gave Agnes some last-minute instructions out of range of the boy's earshot. Agnes would have to be paid in cold cash to keep her big mouth you-know-what. Then she went and got W.E. by the hand, and using the key that Trotter kept, they let themselves into Mr. Randolph's house. The house was dark and damp-feeling, even in the daytime. But fortunately, the boy was used to it and walked right in. Gilly pointed out the top shelf of the bookcase. "He told me he had the stuff right behind that big red book." W.E. looked up. "See which one I'm talking about?" He nodded, then shook his head. "I can't reach it." "Of course not, Stu. I can't reach it either. That's why we both have to do it." "Oh. Now look, I'm going to push this big blue chair over and stand on the arm. Then I want you to climb up the back of the chair and get on my shoulders." He drew back. "I want to wait for Trotter." "We can't do that, William Ernest, honey. You know how hard it is on Trotter climbing up and down. It wouldn't be good for her." He was still hesitant. "Besides, I think it's kind of a surprise for Trotter. Mr. Randolph doesn't want her to know about it yet." The boy came close to the chair and tiptoed up toward her. "I'm scared," he whispered. "Sure you are. But just think, man, how proud everyone's going to be later. After the surprise can be told and everything. When they find out who it was that..." He was already climbing up on the chair. It was an old, solid, overstuffed one, so that when he stood on the arm and then on the back, it never moved. Gilly got up on the chair's fat arm and helped him onto her shoulders and held his legs. The little cuss was heavier than he looked. "Okay, first pull out that big red book I showed you." He grabbed her hair with his left hand and stretched toward the shelf without straightening and pulled out the book. It fell to the floor with a crash. "I dropped it." "Don't worry about it. Just look back there behind where it was." He leaned forward. Ouch! She was afraid he'd take her hair out like weeds from a wet garden. "It's dark." "Look, man. No, stick your hand up in there." She had to shift her balance as he leaned forward to keep from crashing to the floor herself. "Pow!" he said softly, bringing back a dirty fist. In it was a rubber-banded roll of bills. Gilly reached up. "Don't let go of my legs!" He dropped the money and grabbed her hair with both hands. "Is there any more?" "Wait!" Agnes's signal. Gilly nearly fell off the chair as she snatched W.E. off her shoulders, then scrambled back on the top of the chair back, tilted sarsaparilla to sorcery back in place, jumped down, stuffed the roll of bills into her jeans, shoved the heavy chair forward, grabbed a startled William, and dragged him out the back door. "I gotta give it to Mr. Randolph later when Trotter isn't around," she explained to the blinking owl eyes. "Look, I gotta go to the bathroom. You go help Trotter get Mr. Randolph into the house. Oh, and tell Agnes to go home. I'll see her tomorrow." But Agnes was waiting for her in Trotter's hallway, lounging against the stairs. "Find what you was looking for? No luck." Agnes looked down at Gilly's jeans. "Then what's bulging your pocket?" "Okay, I found some, but I didn't find much." "How much did you find?" "Hell, Agnes, I don't know." "I'll help you count." "I swear, Agnes, I'll help you rearrange your nose if you don't get out of here. I promised I'd give you something for helping, and I will, but I can't now, and if you don't understand that, you're in worse shape than I thought." Agnes stuck out her bottom lip. "If it wasn't for me, you'd be caught right now." "I know, Agnes, and I won't forget that, but if you hang around now, we'll both be caught, so get out and keep your mouth shut." Without waiting for further sulks, Gilly pushed past Agnes and ran up the staircase. She shut her door and pulled the bureau in front of it. Then she took out the special drawer and began to tape the money to the bottom with a sinking heart. $34. 34 measly dollars. 44, counting the 10 she had already. It had seemed like more in William's fist and bulging in her jeans. She counted it again to make sure. No, there was no more. 5 $5 bills and 9 ones. It had seemed like more because of all the singles. She laid out a 1 to give to Agnes, then reluctantly swapped it for a 5. Agnes would not be bought off cheaply, she knew. If only she had done it by herself. It cost too much to use people. Why had she thought she couldn't do it alone? She had been in too big a hurry. She should have taken more time, planned more carefully. Now she had gotten both Agnes and W.E. involved, and all for a measly $39. Then, remembering the weight of W.E. on her neck and shoulders and the pain as he yanked her hair in terror, she started to count out another dollar. But that would leave her only 38. It would take a lot more to get even as far as the Mississippi River. She returned W.E.'s dollar to the stack. She would have to search again, but she would go back by herself the next time, as soon as she figured out a plan. Dust. The thought hit her after supper when they were all sitting in the living room watching the evening news. Suddenly she saw it, lying like a gray frost upon the TV set. Dust! She could go on a campaign, dusting first this house and then the other. She jumped to her feet. Trotter! Slowly, Trotter shifted her attention from Walter Cronkite to Gilly. Yeah, honey? Mind if I dust in here? Dust? Trotter spoke the word as though it were the name of an exotic and slightly dangerous game. I guess not. Her gaze slid back toward the screen. Why don't you wait till we're through watching TV, though? Gilly jiggled her foot through a Central American earthquake and the bribery trial of a congressman from who cared where. She couldn't stand waiting. She ran into the kitchen. She now knew how she could get the money on her own, and every minute seemed to matter. Under the sink were some old rags. And could you believe it? A quarter bottle of furniture polish. She poured some in the rags, which she had carefully dampened, just as Mrs. Nevins always did, and proceeded to clean the never-used dining room with its dark, heavy table and 6 chairs. One side of the rag was black in 2 swipes, but Gilly turned it over and poured out more polish. The steady wiping and polishing with the clean, dry cloth fell into a rhythm that began to calm her inner frenzy. By the time she got to the picture over the buffet, she not only cleaned out the niches of the carved frame, but she hunted up Windex and paper towels to wash the faces and so forth of the baby angels who were tripping around on clouds with only a ribbon or a stray wing to cover their private parts, as Mrs. Nevins used to call them. Meantime, in the living room, the volume of Trotter's voice told Gilly that Walter Cronkite had called it a day, but she no longer needed to rush. Gently, she wiped off the last streak of Windex. By supper the next night, she had finished cleaning everything but the living room chandelier. And how could one do that without a stepladder? Oh, forget it, Gilly, honey. The place looks beautiful. No one's going to notice the chandelier, said Trotter. I will, said Gilly. I got to have a tall stool or a stepladder or something. Then I could do the top kitchen cabinets, too. Mercy! Next thing I know, you'll be wiping me right out with all the rest of the trash. William Ernest looked up from his meatloaf in alarm. Mr. Randolph was chuckling. There is no danger of that, Mrs. Trotter. Well, you know what the good book says, dust to dust. No, squeaked William Ernest. You ain't dusty. Oh, bless you, sweetheart. I was only talking crazy. Nobody would take away William Ernest, Mrs. Trotter. Now, will they, Miss Gilly? Mr. Randolph reached out and felt for the boy's head and patted it. Of course not, said Gilly sharply. I just want something to stand on to finish my job. My, my, said Mr. Randolph. You really have yourself a prize helper here, Mrs. Trotter. Young people nowadays, hardly. If you want, Mr. Randolph, she would have to be careful. Talk slowly as though the idea were just occurring to her. I could maybe do your house when I finish here. Of course, I'll have to have a stepladder, probably. Didn't I say she was a prize, Mrs. Trotter? Mr. Randolph was beaming. I might even have a ladder in my basement. Gilly jumped up from the table, then caught herself. Slow down, slow down. Her heart was pumping crazily. She made herself sit down. Maybe after supper I could take a look. I'd sure like to finish that chandelier tonight. Trotter and Mr. Randolph nodded and chuckled happily. People were so dumb sometimes, you always felt bad to take advantage of them. But not too bad. Not when it was your only way to get where you had to go. The stepladder was old and rickety, but it would beat trying to climb those bookshelves in Mr. Randolph's, which looked as though they might come right over on top of you if you pulled at them. She set the ladder up under Trotter's chandelier, and as she painstakingly wiped each piece of glass with her ammonia water rag, she would have to grab the ladder from time to time, dizzy as she was with the smell of the ammonia and the thought that by tomorrow night at this time, she'd be on her way to California. Late that night, she packed the brown bag and shoved it far under the bed. Tomorrow, from the school payphone, she'd call the bus station and find out how much the ticket cost. Then all she had to do was get the rest of the money. Gilly was coming out of the phone booth the next day when Agnes appeared demanding her money. She pretended to be grumpy about the $5 Gilly gave her, but there was a greedy gleam in her eyes. She was pleased, all right. "Can we get more?" she asked. Gilly shook her head. "That's all there was. I split it three ways. Looked like a lot in your pocket yesterday." "Yeah, but the rest was all in ones." "I don't see why you split equal with that weird kid. He wouldn't know the difference." "He's not as dumb as he looks." Gilly looked Agnes straight in the eyes. "He acts stupid, maybe, but if he thought you and me were cheating on him..." Agnes shrugged. "Well," she said, "next time, let's not use him." "Okay, sure, next time," Gilly agreed, knowing happily that there would be no next time with creepy Agnes the Stoke. Tonight, she would be bound for her new life, her real life. She got rid of Agnes at the front gate with some lie about Trotter forcing her to scrub all the dirty pots in the house. Agnes said she'd go on home. She wasn't too crazy about cleaning pots and pans. The stepladder was in the hall. Gilly put her school books down on the table and went right to it. As she was leaning to pick it up, "Gilly, honey, want some snack?" She straightened up quickly. It would be better to eat while she had the chance. She gave the ladder a pat and went into the kitchen. Trotter was sitting at the table. She seemed to have finished her daily Bible reading, for the good book, still open, was pushed to one side. Right before her was a piece of notebook paper, half filled with her square, laborious script. She had a 19-cent ballpoint clutched tightly in her right hand. When Gilly came in, the huge woman smiled shyly at her over the top of her reading glasses. "Writing one of my old children. I do miss him when they grow up and leave me, but the good Lord knows I ain't much at writing." She looked down at her letter and sighed. "There's more of them cookies in the tin box next to the refrigerator." Gilly poured herself a 12-ounce glass of milk and took four of the cookies. "Sit down, Gilly, honey. I ain't really busy." Gilly sat down at the far side of the table. "Things is going better for you now, ain't they, honey?" "Okay. I've been meaning to say to you how much I appreciate the way you've been making friends with William Ernest." "Yeah, okay." "Like Miss Ellis says, you're a special kind of person, Gilly. It makes me praise the Lord to see you so busy helping instead of hurting." "Shut up, Trotter. You got so much to give? Mercy, what most of us wouldn't give for half your brains." "Shut up, Trotter, shut up." The silent commands were obeyed because just then, William Ernest, honey, appeared, and Trotter roused her great hulk from the table to give him his snack. "Trotter, baby, if you had half my brains, you'd know to let the boy do things for himself. If I were going to stay here, I'd teach him how. You want to so hard, and you don't know how. Even the birds know to shove the babies out of the nest. If I were going to be here, I'd make a man of your little marshmallow. But I can't stay. I might go soft and stupid, too, like I did at Dixon's. I let her fool me with all that rockin' and love talk. I called her mama and crawled up on her lap when I had to cry. My God, she said I was her own little baby. But when they moved to Florida, I was put out like the rest of the trash they left behind. I can't go soft. Not as long as I'm nobody's real kid. Not while I'm just something to play musical chairs with. An elbow pierced her ribcage. Gilly jerked awake. What the hell? W.E. was trying to attract her attention without getting Trotters, mouthing some words through a full load of cookie crumbs. Huh? She asked the question by raising her eyebrows. He swallowed, then, surprise, he mouthed, pointing his head in Trotter's general direction. She shook her head with exaggerated vigor. Not yet, she mouthed back. Later. A little grin escaped and danced around Hood's face. Gilly sighed. If she didn't watch herself, she'd start liking the little jerk. She excused herself. I'm going to get on to my dusting over at Mr. Randolph's. W.E. made as if to follow. Nah, William Ernest, you better watch Sesame Street today. I'm going to help you with your reading later on, and you have to be real sharp. Right, Trotter? You better believe it. She knocked several times at Mr. Randolph's door before he opened it, his tie and shirt awry, and his face still clogged with sleep. I brought your stepladder back, Mr. Randolph. Oh, thank you. Just put it down out there on the porch. But, I thought I was, since I was here and had the ladder and all, I might come on in and start to work. Oh, Miss Gilly, you don't have to worry. I was just talking the other night. What I can't see isn't likely to hurt me. I don't mind. I want to help. Every week or so, my son over in Virginia comes and brings a lady to vacuum a little. It's really all I need. But I want to, God, what I mean is I want to help Mrs. Trotter. And you know how she is. She really doesn't need my help. But I figured if I do something for you, it would be like doing something for her. Bless you, you sweet little lady. How can I say no to that? It worked. He stepped aside for her to come in and shuffled along right behind her into the living room. Was he going to stay in there, his sightless eyes following the sound of her? Why don't you just go up and finish your nap, Mr. Randolph? I feel bad waking you up like this. He chuckled and stretched out in the worn blue plush armchair, his feet up on the equally worn stool. He closed his eyes. Wouldn't you rest better up on your bed or something? I'm going to be working in here, making a lot of noise. Mercy, Miss Gilly. I can rest in heaven. In the meantime, it is human company that I treasure. It won't bother you if I just sit here, will it? I promise not to make suggestions. Why don't I come back later? I don't want to bother you. Bother me? I'm delighted. She kept her eyes on the little man as she carefully set up the stepladder at the far end of the bookcase wall. The blue plush chair was exactly where she shoved it 2 days earlier, catty-cornered 3 feet from the place she'd have to set up the ladder in order to reach Sarsaparilla to Sorcery. Excuse me, Mr. Randolph, her voice barely squeaked out. She cleared her throat. Mr. Randolph! Now she was yelling. I'm going to have to move your chair. He got up like an obedient child. Gilly shoved and pushed and tugged the heavy chair to the place opposite the red encyclopedia. She arranged the chair and then the stool, and then took Mr. Randolph's elbow and led him to them. Now your chair's just opposite from where it was before. I hope you haven't strained yourself, Miss Gilly. Right between the end of the couch and the corner of the desk, couple of feet on either side, okay? Fine, fine. He sat down and stretched out again. Gilly went back to the stepladder, climbed the first step, and then back down. I guess I'll begin with the windows over the desk. He smiled his funny little blank-eyed smile. You're the doctor, Miss Gilly. She did the windows and the desk, then moved the ladder around Mr. Randolph to the smaller of the two giant bookcases. She went back and dusted the picture over the couch, which was of fancily dressed white people in another century, having an elaborate picnic in a woods. She kept looking over her shoulder at Mr. Randolph, who lay motionless with his eyes opened. Since he'd been known to sleep on Trotter's couch with his eyes wide open, there was no way under heaven to tell if he were wide awake or dead asleep. But he wasn't snoring. That was worrisome. But, hell, the man was blind and half deaf. Why should it matter in the least that he was sitting right there in the room while she robbed him of money he was too old to remember having? Still, the closer she got to sarsaparilla, the more her heart carried on like the entire percussion section of a marching band doing the Stars and Stripes Forever. At last, she moved the stepladder directly in front of the place and took a step up, glancing sideways at Mr. Randolph. He didn't move. She eased up the ladder, trying not to make any noise, but it creaked and swayed under her weight. From the next to the top step, she could reach sarsaparilla to sorcery without stretching. She braced her left leg hard against the cold metal of the ladder, took out the now familiar volume, and laid it gently on the ladder top. Nothing was visible except dust. She took out books on either side, dusting each one with kind of fury. Still nothing. Mr. Randolph was shifting in his chair across the room. She looked into his blank white eyes. Oh, God, maybe he could really see. Maybe it was all a trick to fool people. She froze. You certainly are doing a beautiful job. So careful. My, my. I don't know when this room has been so thoroughly cleaned before. I'm sort of straightening up the bookshelves. Fine, fine. He was bobbing his head. Now, if there were just some way you could straighten up this old brain of mine as well. She was not going to panic. He couldn't see. Of course he couldn't see. It was really better that he was in the room. Nobody would suspect her of stealing right from under his nose. She dusted the space and then moved sarsaparilla down to the shelf that held the rest of the encyclopedia set. On the shelf from which it had come, she proceeded to remove, one by one, all the other books, wiping carefully behind each one to the dark stained wood at the back of the case. With every book, her hope rose and fell, rising a little less and falling a little more each time. At last she knew that her lie to Agnes had proved all too true. There was no more money. Fear and anticipation curdled in her stomach. She wanted to throw up. Mr. Randolph was chatting away happily. She couldn't seem to tune in the words, just the maddeningly cheerful tone of his high-pitched voice. She wanted to throw a book at the noise, kick over the stepladder, crash a chair through the window, at the very least scream out her frustration. But of course she didn't. Wrapped in a silent, frozen rage, she folded the stepladder and carried it to the basement. "You going now, Miss Gilly?" The voice followed her down and up the steps and out of the house. "Thank you, thank you. Come back for another little visit, won't you? Be sure to tell Mrs. Trotter what a lovely help you've been." She made no attempt to answer him. It didn't matter what he thought. He was of no use to her. 39 stinking dollars. She went straight to her room, took the brown suitcase from under the bed, and unpacked it. Then she ripped out a sheet of paper through the rings of her notebook, lay down on the bed, and pressing on her math book, wrote, 1408 Aspen Avenue, Thompson Park, Maryland. "Dear Courtney Rutherford Hopkins, I received your card. I am sorry to bother you with my problems, but as my real mother, I feel you have a right to know about your daughter's situation. At the present time, it is very desperate, or I would not bother you. The foster mother is a religious fanatic. Besides that, she can hardly read and write and has a very dirty house and weird friends." She started to write colored, but erased it, not sure how Courtney might react. "There is another kid here who is probably mentally retarded. I am expected to do most of the work, including taking care of him," the mentally retarded boy, "which is very hard with all my schoolwork, too. I have saved up $39 toward my ticket to California. Please send me the rest at your earliest convenience." She wrote love, then changed it to, "Yours sincerely, your daughter, Galadriel Hopkins. P.S. I am very smart and can take care of myself, so I will not be a burden to you in any way. P.S. Again, I have checked the cost of the bus ticket to San Francisco. It is exactly $136.60 one way. I will get a job and pay you back as soon as possible. She listened at the top of the stairs until she heard Trotter go into the downstairs bathroom. Then she crept into the kitchen, stole an envelope and a stamp from the kitchen drawer, and ran to the corner to mail her letter before the rage could defrost and change her mind. The one-way ticket. Not everything in the letter to Courtney had been absolutely true, but surely the part about Trotter being a religious fanatic was. She read the Bible and prayed every day, always joining Mr. Randall's grace over the food. Besides, anybody who started for church at 9 in the morning on Sunday and didn't get home until after 12:30 had to be peculiar. Sunday mornings were torture to Gilly. The church was a strange little white frame building stuck up on a hill behind the police station, built when the city was a country town instead of part of the metropolitan Washington sprawl. The church didn't fit in the modern world any more than the people who went there did. The children's Sunday school class, in which both Gilly and W.E. were lumped with the other 5 or 6 to 12-year-olds in the church, was presided over by an ancient Miss Minnie Applegate, who reminded her 7 charges every Sunday that she had been saved by Billy Sunday. Who in the hell was Billy Sunday? He sounded like a character from the comics. Billy Sunday met Brenda Starr. Also, Miss Applegate neglected to say what Billy Sunday had saved her from. A burning building? The path of a speeding locomotive? Or indeed, having been so luckily preserved, what good had her pickling accomplished for either herself or the world? Old Applegate would do things like lecture them on the Ten Commandments and then steadfastly refuse to explain what adultery was. Miss Applegate, an 8-year-old had sensibly asked, if we don't know what adultery is, how can we know if we're doing it or not? Gilly, of course, knew all about adultery. In whispered conversations between Sunday school and church, she offered for sale not only the definition of the word, but some juicy neighborhood examples, which had lately come to her attention, thanks to Agnes Stokes. In this way, she gained 78 cents in coins, previously designated for the church collection plate. The preacher was as young as the Sunday school teacher was old. He, too, was high on getting saved and other matters of eternal preservation. But his grammar was worse than Trotter's, and, to Gilly's disgust, he stumbled over words of more than one syllable whenever he read the Bible. Nobody but a religious fanatic would put up with such gross ignorance for over an hour every week of their lives. Nobody but religious fanatics and the innocent victims they forced to go to church. Unlike some of the women, Trotter didn't carry on over the preacher at the church door, which made Gilly bold enough to ask her once, "How can you stand him?" It was the wrong question. Trotter sucked in her breath and glowered down at her like Moses at the Israelites' golden calf. "Who am I?" she thundered, "to pass judgment on the Lord's anointed. Would anybody but a fanatic say a thing like that?" Mr. Randolph went to the Black Baptist Church. The same taxi that took Trotter and the children to the White Baptist Church dropped him off on the way and picked him up on the way home. Gilly noted that the Black Baptists dressed fancier and smiled more than the whites, but their service lasted even longer, and often W.E. would have to run in and get the old man out of his service while the taxi meter impatiently ticked away. It was usually past 2 by the time they got out of their Sunday clothes, cooked dinner, and finally sat down to their long, lazy meal. The Sunday after the futile dusting, Mr. Randolph surprised everyone by refusing seconds. "Oh, you must know, Mrs. Trotter, how it pains me to say no to this exquisite chicken, but my son is coming over about 3. At the word son, something clanked inside Gilly's chest. Suppose the son noticed that something was funny in Mr. Randolph's living room. The chair on the opposite side, the books rearranged. Suppose he knew where the money should have been. Oh, you got time for a piece of pie now, don't you, Mr. Randolph? It's cherry today. Cherry? My, my. Mr. Randolph held his bony thumb and index finger an inch apart. About so much, all right? I'm helpless before your cherry pies, Mrs. Trotter. Totally helpless. He was chewing the pie blissfully when suddenly he stopped. Oh, my! Have I got any spots on my clothes? My son gets so upset. Trotter put her fork down and studied him. You look good, Mr. Randolph. Only just a little something on your tie. Oh, mercy, mercy. That boy is always looking for some excuse to say I can't take care of myself so he can drag me over to his big house in Virginia. He dipped his napkin into his water glass and tried to dab his tie, completely missing the offending spots. Oh, shoot, Mr. Randolph. Let me get you one of Melvin's old ties to wear. I don't know why I still got so much of his stuff around anymore. She sniffed as if to clear away a memory of the late Mr. Trotter. Gilly, run up to my room and look in the back of the closet, will you? There's a dozen or more on a coat hanger. Before Gilly got out the door, she asked, Just pick a nice one here. Not one of the real loud ones. She turned halfway apologetically to Mr. Randolph. Sometimes in those last years, if Melvin was feeling low, he'd go out and buy some wild tie and wear it every day for a week. She shook her head. I guess I should praise the Lord it wasn't some wild woman he was hanging around his neck. Mr. Randolph giggled. Why don't you bring me a wild one, Miss Gilly? I need to wake up that 50-year-old senior citizen I've got for a son. Trotta threw back her massive head and belly laughed. You're some kind of man, Mr. Randolph. Well, you're some kind of lady. Gilly fled up the stairs. These scenes between Trotter and Mr. Randolph made her insides curl. It was weird to see old people carrying on, old people who weren't even the same color. But it was not that silly little flirtation that was bothering her. It was the vision of Mr. Randolph's prissy 50-year-old son poking around his father's living room. So when she saw Trotter's purse with its no-good fastener lying wide open on the bed, inviting her, practically demanding her to look in, she did so. Good God! Trotter must have just cashed her check from County Welfare. Gilly did a quick count. At least 100. Another 100 would get her all the way to California, all the way to Courtney Rutherford Hopkins, all the way home. She stuffed the money in her pocket, went to the closet and found the hanger full of Melvin's Madness. She chose the gaudiest one there, 4-inch-high ballet dancers in purple tutus, their pink legs pirouetting on a greenish foreign hand. She tiptoed to her own room, slipped the fat wad of bills in her drawer under her T-shirts, and tiptoed back to Trotter's door. Once there, she slammed her feet down and noisily descended the stairs. Oh, my sweet baby, what have you done? Gilly's blood went cold. How could Trotter know? That tie, it's the worst crime Melvin ever committed, rest his precious soul. Oh, good, good. Mr. Randolph was standing up, rubbing his wrinkled hands together in excitement. Tell me about it. You better not take that one, Mr. Randolph. It's got all these fat women jumping around. Really? The little brown face beamed. Are they decent? Well, they ain't naked, but they might as well be. Little purple flim-flams tutus, prompted Gilly primly, gratefully recovering from her earliest shock. What? Asked Trotter. Tutus. They're wearing tutus. Trotter roared. Ain't that perfect? Tutus. Too skimpy for words. Mr. Randolph was already taking off his spotted black tie to make room for Melvin's dancing ladies. You're sure now, Mr. Randolph? I don't want your son thinking I'm some kind of weird influence on his good Baptist father. Gilly began to wonder if poor Mr. Randolph was going to choke on his own giggles. He doesn't ever need to know where the tie came from. I give you my solemn word. This from a man hysterical with laughter. Jeez. Trotter knotted the tie for him with a kind of assured expertise born of knotting one man's tie for more than a quarter of a century. She stepped back to appraise the effort. Well, what do you think, Gilly, honey? that do something for Mr. Randolph? It's okay. Okay, we got to do better than that. How about you, William Ernest Honey? How do you like Mr. Randolph's new tie? It's beautiful, the boy whispered reverently. See? Well, Trotter was immediately sober. William Ernest approves. Good, good, said Mr. Randolph, his dignity almost once again intact. Would you walk with me back to my house then, son? The boy slid out of his chair and took the old man's hand. See you tomorrow here, Trotter said. Thank you, yes, thank you. And you too, Miss Gilly. See you tomorrow. Yeah, okay, said Gilly, though by this time tomorrow she figured to be in Missouri at the very least. She dried the dishes as Trotter washed them and put them to drain, her mind aboard the Greyhound bus, skimming across something that looked like a three-dimensional version of the topographical map in her geography book. Trotter beside her was chuckling again over Mr. Randolph sporting Melvin's dancing ladies. His son's this big lawyer. Lawyer over in Virginia. I'd give a pretty penny to see his face when he gets a load of that tie. Mercy on us, wouldn't I ever? After they finished cleaning up in the kitchen, Trotter went into the living room and stretched out on the couch. Her one trip upstairs on Sundays was to change out of her good dress, so she'd be on the couch the rest of the day napping or laboriously reading the Sunday paper. W.E., back from next door, turned on the TV and lay down on the rug to watch an old movie. Now was the time. Gilly started for the stairs. You want to join us, honey? There's a football game on Channel 9, lest W.E. cares about this movie. W.E. got up, obediently ready to switch channels. No, Gilly said. Not right now. I got things to do. Well, okay, honey. If she was going to go, she would have to leave now. By tonight, Trotter would go upstairs and find the money gone, and nothing was sure about what might happen with Mr. Randolph's lawyer son next door. She packed quickly, although her hands shook. The first thing was to gather all the money together and put it into her pocket. It made a lump as big as an orange. Too bad she'd thrown away that silly shoulder bag Mrs. Nevins had bought her last Christmas. Her jacket. First thing next week, I'm going to have to buy you a good warm coat, Trotter had said. She had been waiting for the support check. Her jacket was hanging by the front door, downstairs, past the open living room door. Trotter was probably asleep, and if Gilly was very quiet, perhaps W.E. wouldn't hear. She crept down, keeping her suitcase under her right arm to conceal it as best she could with her body. Crossing the short, bright strip before the door, she glanced in. Neither head turned. She was safely to the front door. She took her jacket off the hook and poked it above the suitcase so that she had a free hand for the knob. Where are you going? She jumped around at W.E.'s whisper. In the dark hallway, his glasses flashed. Just out, she whispered back. Oh, God, make him shut up. He did shut up and stood silently, looking first at her, then at the suitcase, then back at her. Don't go. His little face squeezed up at her like his tiny voice. I got to, she said through her teeth, opening the door, pulling it shut behind her, shifting the suitcase and jacket to either hand, and running down the hill, the pulse in her forehead pounding so hard as her sneakered feet pounded on the sidewalk. Once around the corner, she slowed down. Someone might notice her if they saw her running. No bus came by. There were hardly any on Sundays. She settled herself at once to walk the mile or so to the bus station, stopping to put on her thin jacket against the November wind. The bus would be heated, she reminded herself, and in California, the sun always shines. It was dusk by the time she got to the bus station. She went straight to the ladies' room and combed her hair and tucked her shirt into her jeans. She tried to tell herself that she looked much older than 11. She was tall, but totally busless. Hell. She zipped up her jacket, stood up straight, and went out to the ticket counter. The man didn't even look up. I want a ticket to California, please. As soon as the words were out, she heard her mistake. California where? He glanced up now, looking at her through half-open lids. San Francisco. San Francisco, California. One way or round trip. Whatever happened to Lady Cool? One way. He punched some buttons and a ticket magically emerged. 136.60, including tax. She had it. She had enough. With trembling hands, she took the wad of bills from her pocket and began to count it out. The man watched lazily. Your mother know where you are, kid? Come on, Gilly. You can't fall apart now. She pulled herself straight and directed into his sleepy eyes the look she usually reserved for teachers and principals. I'm going to see my mother. She lives in San Francisco. Okay, he said, taking her money and recounting it before he handed her the ticket. Bus leaves at 8:30. 8:30? Yeah, want to check your bag? It's only 4:30 now. That's right. That's 4 hours from now. Right again. But I want to leave as soon as I can. Look, kid, you came in here and asked me for a ticket. I gave you one on the next bus, he sighed. Okay, he said, and consulted his book. You can take the 5 o'clock into Washington and catch a 6:22 out of there. He stuck out his hand. I'll have to fix you another ticket. She gave it back. It'll take a while, he said. I gotta check the routing. He nodded to the seats across the waiting room. Just sit down over there. I'll call you. She hesitated, then reluctantly obeyed. She didn't like the idea of leaving both the money and the ticket there, but she was afraid he'd ask more questions if she protested. He was a long time at it. He was on the phone a while, talking in a muffled voice. Then he was poring through his books. Once he got up and went back into the baggage room and stayed away for several minutes. It was almost 4:45. If she didn't hurry, she might miss the 5 o'clock bus. She got up and got a drink from the water cooler. The water was warm, and somebody had dropped a piece of gum on the drain. She went back to the red plastic seat, still thirsty. The clock said 4:48 when the clerk came back and sat down without even looking her way. My ticket? But just then a man and a woman came in, and the clerk got busy with them. It wasn't fair. She had been there waiting since 4:30. Gilly stood up and started for the counter. She didn't even see the policeman until she felt his hand on her arm. Gilly snatched her arm back as she looked to see who had touched her. Where are you headed, little girl? He spoke quietly as though not to disturb anyone. To see my mother, said Gilly tightly. Oh, God, make him go away. All the way to San Francisco by yourself? She knew then the clerk had called him. Damn. Yes, I see, he said with a quick look at the clerk, who was now staring at them with both eyes well open. I haven't done anything wrong. Nobody's charging you with anything. The policeman pulled his cap straight and said in a very careful, very patient voice, Who you been staying with here in the area? She didn't have to answer him. It was none of his business. Look, somebody's going to be worried about you. Like hell. He cleared his throat. What about giving me your telephone number so I can just check things out? She glared at him. He coughed and cleared his throat again and looked up at the clerk. She might have gotten away in that instant, except for the money. Where could she go without the money? I think, the policeman was saying, I'd better take her in for a little talk. The clerk nodded. He seemed to be enjoying himself. Here's the money she brought in. He held up a manila envelope. The policeman took her gently by the arm and walked her to the counter. The clerk handed him the envelope. That's my money, Gilly protested. I'll just bet it is, kid, the clerk said with a fake smile. If she had known what to do, she would have done it. She tried to make her brain tell her, but it lay frozen in her skull like a woolly mammoth deep in a glacier. All the way to the station, she asked it, Shall I jump out of the car at the next light and run? Shall I just forget about the damn money? But the woolly mammoth slept on, refusing to stir a limb in her behalf. In a back room behind the police station's long counter, two policemen tried to question her. The new one, a big blonde, was asking the first question. She ain't got no ID. Well, I'm not going to search her, and Judy's gone out to get her supper. What about the suitcase? Yeah, better check through there. She wanted to yell at them to leave her stuff alone, but she couldn't break through the ice. The blonde policeman rifled carelessly through her clothes. He found Courtney's picture almost at once. "This your mother, kid?" "Put that down," she whispered. "Oh, now she's talking." "She said to put her picture down, Mitchell." "Okay, okay, just trying to do my job." He put the picture down and continued to poke through the suitcase. "Bingo," he said, picking up the postcard. He read it carefully before handing it to the other officer. "All here, Ryan. Name and current address." "And big surprise, she does know somebody in San Francisco." The one called Ryan read the postcard and then came and stooped down beside her chair. "Is this your father's address here?" he asked, pointing at the address on the card. She sat perfectly still, staring him down. Ryan shook his head, stood up, and handed the card back to Mitchell. "Check out who lives at that address and give them a call, will you?" Within a half hour, a red-faced trotter holding the hand of a white-faced William Ernest puffed through the station house door. Her eye immediately caught Gillies, still seated in the room on the other side of the counter. She tried to smile, but Gilly jerked away from the gaze. The policewoman was back from her supper and on duty at the counter. "Mamie! Mamie Trotter!" Trotter was puffing worse than if she'd run up the steps. "Got a taxi waiting. No money to pay him." "Just a minute, please." Judy, the policewoman, came in and spoke quietly to Ron, and then Ryan got up and they both went out to the counter. The only part of the conversation Gilly could make out was Trotter's breathy replies. "Foster child. Yes. Somewhere. San Francisco. Yes. Maybe so. County Social Services. Ms. Miriam Ellis. Yes, yeah, no. Can someone pay the taxicab? Still waiting out there." Officer Ryan gave Trotter the yellow envelope. She sighed and nodded, taking out some money, which she handed to him. He handed it to Mitchell, who handed it to the policewoman, who frowned but went out anyway to pay the cab driver. No, Trotter was saying. "Of course not. She's just a baby." Trotter was still shaking her head at Ryan as he brought her back around the counter, W.E. clutching at her shabby coat. Trotter's breath had returned, but her voice shook as she spoke to Gilly from the doorway. "I came to take you home, Gilly, honey. Me and William Ernest came up to get you." Ryan came all the way in and stooped down again beside her. "Mrs. Trotter is not going to press charges. She wants you to come back." "Press charges? Oh, the money. Did the stupid man think that Trotter would have her arrested? But how could she go back? Gilly the Great, who couldn't even run away, botched the job." She stared at her fingers. The nails were grubby. She hated grubby fingernails. "Gilly, honey, don't you want to go home?" Ryan was asking her. "Want to go home? Don't I want to go home? Where in the hell do you think I was headed?" When she didn't answer him, Ryan stood up. "Maybe we should keep her tonight and call social services in the morning." "You mean to lock the child up?" "She'd be safe. It would just be overnight." "You don't think for one minute I'm going to let you lock a child of mine up in jail?" "Maybe it would be best," Ryan said quietly. "Best? What do you mean? What are you trying to say?" "She really doesn't seem to want to go with you, Mrs. Trotter. Now, I don't know." "Oh, my dear Lord, you don't. Oh, my dear Lord." It was the closest to cursing Gilly had ever heard Trotter come to. She looked up into the fat-stricken face. "Oh, my dear Lord, what can I do?" "Gilly, Gilly," William Ernest streaked across the room and began to beat his fist on her knees. "Come home, Gilly. Please come home. Please, please." The blood vessel stood out blue and strained on his white neck. The ice in her frozen brain rumbled and cracked. She stood up and took his hand. "Thank you, precious Jesus," Trotter said. Ryan cleared his throat. "You don't have to go unless you want to. You know that, don't you?" Gilly nodded. Trotter in the doorway lifted her arms, the brown purse dangling from one of them. The faulty clasp flew open as she did so. She dropped her arms, embarrassed, and forced the purse shut. "I need another taxi, officer." "I'll get Mitchell to drive you," he said.